Okay, welcome to Literacy Works, the Bedrock-hosted podcast that it has the primary intent of getting the experts from various subjects and various topics across the education sector straight to you and your device. We really want to get the best people on to talk about a range of things. And today I'm really thrilled, actually, that we were able to kind of get hold of our first guest, actually, Kate Stockings, who's a geography expert. And first of all, you know, I want to be upfront about this. I want to lay the platform for the experts to speak. I want to lay the platform for the best people to say what they need to say. So welcome, Kate, and thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Andy.
Oh, it's fantastic. I'm so pleased we got you nice and early. So first of all, could you just give us a bit of background about, you know, who you are and your role and that type of thing. I think that will be a really nice place to start.
Yeah, absolutely. So my name's Kate Stockings, as you said, and I am a very proud geographer. I'm currently doing a trust lead role. So I've been working, it's my second academic year as trust lead for geography for future academies. Before that, I was full-time in the classroom for 7 years, of which the majority of them were head of geography. So I went to two different schools, both with very kind of a situation that required Key Stage 3 to be overhauled kind of from scratch. And I absolutely loved that, loved doing that twice in each school, and then ended up in this trust lead role, which is what I'm doing for now. Still doing a fair bit of teaching, not as much as a full-time head of department, but a fair bit of teaching. But alongside that, a lot of big thinking, curriculum work, a lot of coursework, a lot of field work, basically just anything and everything to do with geography, which I am loving.
Fantastic. And there's a couple of bits in there, actually. Before I move into the bits I want to really follow up there is, I do want to ask every guest, if you weren't doing something educated related right now, what would it be and why?
It's a very interesting question. It depends if it's a realistic alternative or not. The realistic alternative was that I always quite fancied the police. Don't know why.
Nice.
I think that's quite a common answer for teachers. But yeah, I quite fancied the police. I quite fancied kind of backroom detective-y type stuff.
Nice.
But in an absolute ideal world, I would be living a life of sport and exercise. Not a professional athlete, just kind of the enjoyment of a day revolving around sport and exercise and being outside. And sadly, that doesn't quite add up financially, but that would be the ideal scenario.
What sports do you play?
Netball, running, cross country, just taken over as team manager for my cross country club. Yeah, mainly running is the main one, but I would happily do anything and everything for 5 days a week if that were
lovely. Yeah, that would be nice, wouldn't it? Yeah, in a different world. So there's a couple of bits there before we get into the other parts as well. You said about overhauling the Key Stage 3 curricula in a couple of different places. Did you do that in a couple of different ways? Did you go about that in a similar way? How did those two curriculum projects sort of develop?
They both happened very organically as the result of kind of the need to update the geography. And that was fundamentally the starting point, was that the geography was quite dated. Mm-hmm. And at the first one, we kind of had a regional study on China, but it was very outdated and didn't really reflect China as a possible future superpower. It was more a regional study of China as the largest country in the world. So outdated, Horn of Africa would be another example. So there were those topics. Again, regional studies, but quite weak in their implementation and weak in their kind of thought out of what they were intending to cover in those topics. So largely outdated, but the way I took them, the two approaches I took was very different. But to be honest, that's more a reflection on kind of my leadership and management as opposed to the geography. So the first time I did it, I was a little bit like a bull in a china shop. I've been very honest about this in a number of different forums, kind of what you learn about middle management. And in the first school, I kind of just went in and said, oh my goodness, we need to change this. The second school was much more, okay, we need to change it as a team and we need to work together as a team of four. I was very lucky that it was the same team of four for the 4 years that we worked together. So it was very stable and we very much went on that journey. And by the time I left that curriculum at the end of those 4 years, I was very, very proud of it. And I hope the other three would say the same as well about what we achieved together. And we didn't go for a tactic of one of us was on year seven, one was on year eight, one was on year nine. It was very much right, this is our 3-year journey, which is part of the larger 7-year journey. And how are we going to make that as good as possible? And so it was kind of a working together on all of it. You know, some people had ownership of some schemes of work, but it wasn't divvied up without that connection going through. So yeah, really, really enjoyed that time as head of department. Thought that my head of department days were possibly over, but now in this role I'm like, oh no, maybe I'll go back. I love it too much. Maybe I'll go back and do another couple of stints at overhauling Key Stage 3, because it's that journey when you look back on it, kind of 4 years. I'd love to do it for longer. I'd love to stay for kind of 5, 6 years, 7 years, 8 years, 9 years, and just reap those rewards and be like, this is the result of a really, really fantastic curriculum. So we'll see.
Well, I think that's really interesting, because there has, for obvious reasons, various reasons, been more of a focus on curriculum over the last few years across all subjects. And the natural, when we discussed at Bedrock about putting together a podcast, the natural way in was to sort of talk about disciplinary literacy in different subjects. You know, let's do a one on this. And that's kind of, that's the thread we want to pull on. But before we get into that, I think one of the things that curriculum has really, the focus on curriculum has sort of forced the agenda is, for you, you've reflected on it there in terms of how the journey unravels for the learners over the course of those years, and then seeing how that develops. And I don't think you can really reap the benefits of quality curriculum design for a good 3-4 years when the pupil goes through that body of knowledge. Would you agree with that in terms of of really thinking about the journey that the learner has?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, over the last few years, we've been very, very big on intent. And we saw that massive work around curriculum intents, be that roadmaps, be that curriculum maps. But fundamentally, it was about the thinking. What are we intending to do? And then we kind of moved on to implementation, but we've never really spoken about impact in the depth that it deserves. And thinking about, okay, how do we actually evaluate what changes we've made to this curriculum? And how do we know that we've done a good job? And exactly as you say, you kind of reap that rewards when you go through it, and when you're there for a good chunk of time to see the journey those learners go on. But also I think you reap the rewards in terms of the quality of the teaching, because actually the first time you teach year 7, 8 and 9, you cannot, to the best of your ability, draw those links. You haven't taught it. It's very, very difficult. Yeah. You can be told what the links are and you can do your best, but it's not the absolute kind of beautiful curriculum journey that's envisaged. I would say it kind of takes, you know, you have to have done the entirety of Key Stage 3 before actually you can go back to year 7 and say, right, now I really understand why we're doing this topic here, why we're going to revisit it in year 8, and then we're going to consolidate this piece of knowledge in year 9 before you go on to GCSE and A-level. So I think actually we often forget that it's the quality of teaching that really improves as well. Obviously that goes on to impact the learner as well, but actually it's about that teaching, and about that teaching you can see happening in the classroom when someone is A, really confident of their curriculum, and B, been through it before.
I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think, you know, certainly speaking from a middle leader perspective myself as well, and someone who's gone in and looked at a department and looked at a curriculum and kind of been responsible for developing a new one. What something that was missed on the three I's, the intent, implementation and impact kind of axis really, was perhaps there wasn't enough to do with the teacher. It was all about how can we impart this onto the learner and then assess how that was done. But actually, a deeper piece of thinking needs to happen around teacher development.
I try and avoid just using those language, because people automatically assume that as soon as you say intent and impact and implementation, they think, oh, Ofsted, but actually they are the right words to use for what we're thinking about. And it's about a much broader rationale than just doing it for Ofsted. And it's about actually what is the best curriculum we can have to deliver as teachers and for students to study and learn and be the best that they can be at our subject for however long they're studying it. For some of them in geography, that is only 3 years of Key Stage 3, but for some of them that's 7 years. So what are we going to do to facilitate them to be the very best they can be at the end of A-level for those of them that do come on that 7-year journey with us?
I certainly found that my own outcomes, if that's one way of judging it, my own teaching outcomes and my own results as a teacher in my class's results, for example, and my department's, were improved once I started asking those questions that you were talking about there. So not just being that kind of narrow linear journey towards one exam, but actually how can you work and how can you kind of broaden the concepts out and the deeper thinking and the deeper meaning with the subject. And that leads me quite nicely actually to the kind of what I really wanted to ask you before we move into the final part of the discussion really is about what do you think is unique about the subject of geography when it comes to all those things you just discussed there, when it comes to things like, you know, intent and implementation, what does it mean to make a child a geographer in the 21st century?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it's a really hard question because I think so many of us that do that thinking about curriculum, we know what it means to be a geographer. We can just say it, but it's so much of it is so kind of intangible because you know when you're thinking like a geographer and you walk down your local high road and you're looking at the empty shops and you're looking at the street furniture and you're looking at the Lime scooters that have popped up and you're looking at all of that through a geographical lens and you know as a subject expert that that's what it means to be a geographer. How do you translate that like intangible thinking ability A into the classroom and B into non-specialists? It's really, really difficult.
And it's the thinking before the thinking, isn't it? You know, so if you get a source, a geographical source, by the time you've started even reading word one on that source or you've engaged with even one tiny part of whatever the source or the information is, you're bringing so much to the table, aren't you? As you say, you're talking there about walking down the street and looking at it through the lens of a geographer. That means nothing to me because I'm not a geographer. I can't do that. And I think even as an English expert, I'm going into the room with all sorts of things that I'm perhaps in danger of assuming my pupils might know, but they don't. I think that's a really interesting point.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, you take a kind of thing about the English equivalent. I read a book and I either enjoy the story or I don't enjoy the story. Yeah. And I'm very much about the plot. And I actually don't like those books that are really thematic and kind of, you know, I'm thinking the ones that are, you know, so about relationships. I'm there for the plot and I openly admit that. But that's because I'm not kind of a specialist in literature and in all the literacy things that go on like deeper in the book.
Right, so geographer plot driven. Did you watch the latest Indiana Jones film? Are you an Indiana Jones fan? Because that's got to be about. Oh, that's outrageous.
No, I don't watch films. It's a very publicly out there.
Really?
Fact. I can't sit still long enough to watch a film. So no.
How about if, as a thank you for coming on our podcast, we get you the novelization of an Indiana Jones film? How would that make you feel?
Could do, yeah. If it's in book format, we're much more much more aligned there.
But I think that's interesting. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, and that's what's really difficult, and it's actually particularly difficult in the age of education that we're in now, because we as geographers know that if you're going to be a geographer, you've got to question like a geographer. You've got to see that infographic or that picture or that graph that your teacher puts on the screen, and you've got to question it, and you say, okay, so this is the knowledge that graph is giving me, but what knowledge is that graph not giving me, or what does it not tell me about the future or not tell me about the past, and what knowledge can I bring in, etc. So it's all about questioning. It's all about inquiry. But my goodness, has that word fallen out of fashion in the kind of broader education landscape over the last however long. So actually, as geographers, when you ask me that question, what is a geographer? It's even more kind of pertinent now in the age of retrieval practice, the age of like knowledge and retrieval stuff. Because if we're going to create really great geographers, yes, of course we have to do all that, but we also have to remember that to be a geographer is to question, and we have to give the students the opportunity to inquire about the world around them. And one of the hardest things in my role at the moment is kind of squaring that circle with people who are non-specialists, who don't mean anything. They don't mean it in a kind of rude way, but they kind of say, yeah, but Kate, inquiry learning's not, that's not what we're doing. That doesn't align with what we're doing. It's like, oh, but hang on a second. I mean inquiry-based learning in a really subject-specific way. And actually it's a fundamental part of our subject. So it's a really interesting thing to think about, full stop, but it's particularly interesting at the moment with the way through which education is kind of viewed at this particular point in time.
When I first came into teaching, but just over 10 years ago, inquiry-based learning was very much in vogue. It was very much kind of all big thinking, big topics, and schools were getting pupils to undertake topics and produce infographics and all this type of thing. And that, I think they were really good projects in and of themselves. But I think one thing that was left behind at that stage, and the reason why it fell out of vogue, was because it wasn't underpinned with enough knowledge, enough of a foundation of knowledge and facts. Whereas I think you make a really important point, is that actually in some ways we've flitted too much the other way. We've gone too much the other way. And we're not perhaps encouraging our young people to be as inquisitive and as inquiring and as questioning as perhaps they might like, that they should be to be successful in that subject, right?
Yeah, it's really interesting. And, you know, I don't want to speak out of geography because I'm not an expert in those. Mm-hmm. I agree with what you've just said as a geographer. And for the geography subject community, I hear what you've just said and say yes. And we as a community have to be really careful of that.
Yeah.
We have to be really careful that when we're in schools and being kind of these top-down policies about knowledge are coming, of course we need to embrace them. Of course everything we need to do needs to be underpinned by really powerful knowledge and really clear core and hinterland knowledge, absolutely.
Yeah.
But we have to keep the essence of our subject, which is to inquire about the world around us. Now, whether non-geographers listen to this and that resonates with them, I don't know. As I say, I'm not like an expert in those subjects, but for me, it's just so on my radar with the geographers, because I go into quite a few classrooms where that inquiry like thread is kind of being lost or been weakened. It's either been lost or it's been weakened. But without that, you're delivering students this geographical knowledge. But are they ever going to be a geographer? Or are they actually going to be incredibly knowledgeable about the world, which is important? But can they do anything with that? Can they be a geographer? Yeah. Because they can be quite two very different things. They don't have to be, but they can be.
Yeah, and I think it's something you said earlier struck a bit of a nerve with me. You hinted the idea that actually for as long as they do the subject, that's what it's meaningful for them. You know, that's what we need to make the most of, even if it's for a couple of years or until they might drop it and not do it at GCSE, whatever it is. I think that is irrelevant. It's about giving them a meaningful experience for the time they're in the classroom, to think critically and to be able to engage with the subject and with your subject that you love and which is important to you in a way which is meaningful. Because I've not done geography since GCSE, but I still like to think that I have retained some of those things since then, not developed them anywhere like, you know, a geography teacher has. But I think it's important to at least expose young people to different types of thinking. So before we do move on, I just want to ask you, if you were to say, for example, look at that skill or that concept, if you like, of inquiry, because that's the one we've talked about so far, what would that look like for you from 7 through to the end of A level, for example? Obviously, I'm not asking you to give me a whole curriculum in 2 minute précis, but what does that look like in those different year groups for you?
I think it looks like the kind of the progression of the independence of thought, because, you know, the vast majority of year sevens, when they come into our classroom, are not very independent in their geographical thought, understandably, because it hasn't been structured to them and they don't have that bedrock of knowledge that they need in order to ask those questions. So they don't.
Bedrock, again, product pitch, bedrock, everyone. Sorry, carry on.
That was a good one by me. you know, it's a sweeping generalization, but let's go with it. The vast majority of year sevens will not have studied the coastal landscape in a lot of depth. So therefore, they can't inquire about that as a geographer yet. When we teach them it and when we structure that thinking and teach them that knowledge and teach them what we know has happened and the processes that happen at the coast, and then say, right, let's think about the future and what might change in the future. Let's think about climate change and how that might have an impact, all of that sort of stuff. They can then take that thinking and hopefully, if it's done well, apply it to a river's landscape or apply it to a glacial landscape or apply it to a cold environment or a hot environment, whatever it may be. But as the years go on, as they go through that 7-year journey, whichever element of geography we're talking about, be it human geography processes, physical geography processes, field work processes, my interpretation of what it means to be a geographer and to inquire like a geographer would be to do it more independently. So to have less structure given to you, but be able to question. So I would hope that you'd be able to take the vast majority of sixth formers, for example, to a location and say, right, look around. What do we know? What do we absolutely know are the geographical processes that are happening here, both physical or human or both? What do we not know, but you know of in another context that we can apply here? And then, you know, what broader questions can we ask? What other knowledge can you draw on? And I think that would be it for me, that kind of independence of thought, of geographical thought that we set them up for. And then ultimately, if they go off to university and they're told, right, write a dissertation, they can go, yeah, cool. You know, what shall I do it on? I've got so many choices. How on earth do I choose? Whereas at A-level, you know, we give them an element of choice, but it's not a completely free choice. So that would be it for me. But I think the geography community did a massive piece of work on what inquiry was. We have to kind of keep that beacon alive, if you like, given where we are in education at the moment. And we need to kind of keep banging that drum about what it means to be a geographer. Because if we sit back and assume that everyone knows and assume that the next generation coming through know how important inquiry is in geography, then we're at risk of looking back in 10 years and going, oh, why in the early 2020s did inquiry and geography become so weak? If we don't kind of keep banging the drum and keep talking about it, we could find ourselves in that position. We can't take it for granted that all our teachers are going to indefinitely know this really important part of our subject.
I think with disciplinary literacy in particular, it is all about, I think when I first was trained and introduced to the concept of it, I went straight upstairs and thought, right, disciplinary literacy terms for English, how can I, like, you know, teach 10-20 words that's gonna make me a good disciplinary literacy teacher? And I completely missed the point. And what disciplinary literacy really is, it's about the fusion of knowledge with experience, isn't it? It's about the fusion of knowledge with experience that we can provide them in the curriculum, that also that they are then able to kind of pull on themselves as they get a bit older. And that's what you're saying, I suppose, really, isn't it? As they go through the curriculum, whether it's experiences inside, outside of the classroom, it's how can you continually fuse that knowledge with the experience that they can then become creative thinkers themselves or creative inquirers themselves, right? That's the idea, isn't it? It's the marrying of those two ideas together.
Yeah, I'd say so. And obviously a really important part of that is to be able to speak like a geographer, because that's how you're going to expose or show, whatever word you want to use, that's how you're going to show your geographical knowledge. Because actually it's that specific nature of the language you're using. Okay, sure. When you're in perhaps year 7 or year 6, you might say money, and you might say, oh, you know, this country is wealthier than this country because, or these people have more money as a result of their job, whatever it may be, you might use money. Actually, that doesn't enable you to show that much geographical understanding if you're just using the term money for everything. Because actually, to be a really good geographer, you need to talk about capital where it's appropriate. You need to talk about revenue, profit, income, investment, all of those different terms for forms of money where appropriate, because that shows actually your like geographical understanding of what's going on. So that would be kind of an example of where actually to be a really great geographer is to use the specific language that enables you to fully demonstrate your knowledge.
And what's the term? I'm going to show my ignorance here. What's the term for all the goods and services and the value of an economy of a particular country? Do you know GDP? What I mean? When you, GDP, that sort of thing.
Like, product.
Yeah. But those sorts of, because I think
that
you're
was
right.
A fluffy definition you gave me. That was fluffy.
Well, you know, I'm not thinking like a geographer, but I think it shows that actually I don't fully understand that concept. I'm not fully able to kind of talk about geography in the way that the geography community are. And that's probably just my general ignorance as a human being rather than a geographer. But, I think that's quite interesting.
GDP is a really good one, because, you know, we'll excuse your fluffy definition, but I'll give you a better one. And if we're defining GDP as the total value of goods and services produced in a given country in a given year, we're talking about obviously the domestic production within that country. Now, something I see in a fair few schools when I'm kind of out and about is they loosely define GDP in year seven. So in year seven, when they first use the term GDP, they kind of define it in quite a fluffy way, almost like you did, I suppose.
Thanks very much. Yeah, yeah. Take a bow there.
A fluffy way, which in year seven, you know, we could argue either way. We could argue it's not appropriate. We could argue actually it's okay. And we could say our GDP, you know, is all the stuff produced in a country.
That's pretty much what I think it is.
The problem is when you get to GCSE and you have to teach them GNI and GDP, if you've gone through the school with a fluffy definition of GDP, you then have to unpack that to clarify the difference between GNI and GDP. Now, as I say, there's no kind of one given approach of how you're going to do it. But when you're thinking about vocabulary, you have got to think, hang on, by doing it this way at this point in time, what is that going to mean for my journey later? And you need to make that curriculum decision. So actually in year seven, would it be more appropriate to define GDP properly and give them the really long, you know, it is long, the long.
Get your hands dirty with it.
Get your hands dirty, define it properly. So that by the time you introduce GNI, you haven't got to unpack anything of GDP. Another example would be sustainability. You know, are you letting them get away with a really fluffy definition of sustainability lower down the school that then when you get to GCSE, you have to unpack and say, hang on a second, let me give you a more full definition. Now, my suggestion would be to look at your curriculum critically and say, actually, we need to define these words properly from the word go. Now, that might mean that you have to remove some content somewhere because you might need to spend a whole hour thinking about sustainability in all its different guises and thinking about social sustainability, economic sustainability, environmental sustainability. And that is going to take longer than just giving them one fluffy definition. However, is that going to set you up for more success in the future? I'd argue, yes, it is, if you spend that time. And so that's a curriculum choice you've got to make. Now, of course, the problem is you can't do that for every single tier three great geography term because you'd never cover anything else other than those excellent geography terms. So it all comes down to, again, those curriculum decisions and those curriculum conversations as a department. What words are we going to get our fingers dirty with and really unpack? Which words are we not going to?
It's interesting, just splitting this a little bit, because when we had our kind of pre-chat about the podcast last week, I demonstrated Mapper 2, didn't I? Bedrock Mapper, the idea that we have this big repository of words where you can effectively take from 37,000 words in the whole curriculum and sequence them in very specific areas for the pupils to kind of to experience them as you want. And one thing I've and it's really powerful because it's not just a quiz, it's synonyms, antonyms, images, all that stuff, critical thinking. But what's interesting about it, and it's what you've just said there, is that it doesn't take anything special to just look at keyword lists in a topic and then have a PDF from some other school's done, a knowledge organised from another school, throw it in front of the pupils, off you go. But actually, as you said there, the importance is about the quality of conversation about the curriculum, right? It's about never mind, you know, these 50 words that, you know, a link with this topic that the pupils have to learn and, oh, make flashcards, off you go. It's about having the integrity and the credibility to slim those down and unlocking that powerful knowledge for the pupils. Is that what I'm picking up from what you're saying there about the quality of curriculum conversations?
Yeah, definitely. I think the problem with geography is that you can't slim it down to 10 words in a topic. You can slim it down to the 10 most important, but you can't slim it down to 10 essential tier three words that will unlock this topic, because there is always more than 10. And I'm happy to be corrected on that if anyone wants to give me an example. But I genuinely can't think of an example of a topic where you would only have 10 tier three words.
No, and in English, I always give the example of A Christmas Carol, because I mean, there'll be probably English teachers that will be shouting about this if I say this, but you know, I think that you probably, you know, there's a lot of tier two words and trickier words in A Christmas Carol that you probably have to explicitly teach and unpack with the pupils. But actually, you probably can get away with slimming some of the tier two vocabulary down when it comes to things like malevolent, misanthropic, things like that, because there's loads, but you can probably unlock the key meaning of the text with less. Whereas in geography, you know, I gave the example before, but then you're looking at, you do need technical terminology to refer to such a complex range of very specific concepts to be an accurate geographer, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm trying to think of the best example. There's so many. We could talk about the rivers topic. We could talk about development topic. Development probably is more a better example for those that are non-geographers. But, you know, in that first lesson of development, regardless of what age group we're talking about, in that first lesson of development, you, as a minimum, need to introduce them to birth rate, death rate, infant mortality, natural increase, you know, how you're going to define your countries, emerging, developing, developed, all of that tier three language. And someone might say, oh, well, birth rate isn't a tier three language, it's tier two. Well, it's tier two, to come back to what we were saying before, it's tier two if we accept that fluffy definition. And if you're going to let them get away with a fluffy definition of birth rate is the number of babies born, well, yes, okay, that's perhaps a tier two phrase. But actually, you come into real problems if that's how you define birth rate. Birth rate, I would argue, is a tier three word because it's defined as the number of living babies born per 1,000 of the population per year. Now, a non-geographer goes, okay, you're just being pedantic. Like, why does a per 1,000 per year bit matter? Well, hang on a second. In the next lesson, if we're going to prepare development indicators and we're going to look at birth rate, the number has to be per 1,000 of the population per year. Otherwise, you can't compare. You can't compare China with a population of 1.4 billion to the UK with a population of 64 billion unless the students absolutely know that birth rate is the number of live babies per 1,000. So we come back to that idea of fluffy definitions that then get us in a right pickle, because when you try and unpack it or do anything with that knowledge, it's really problematic. And I think that it's the beauty, but it's the difficulty of geography that is actually so much of the language you use in every topic is tier three, if you're going to do it properly. And that's the big disclaimer, if you're going to do it properly, is tier three language. That a lot of the stuff I see kind of out and about on Twitter and stuff like that works for geography to an extent, but doesn't actually deal with that problem, which is how are you going to decide what words to do this for? You know, things like the Freya model. If we did that for every single tier three word in geography, we wouldn't do any teaching. It's why I've personally never been a fan of it, because how on earth do you decide which ones are so essential? So it's a really, vocabulary in geography is so interesting to think about, but it's also really, really difficult for those reasons that we're kind of exploring.
You're constantly trying to sort of counterbalance breadth and depth, aren't you, all the time? Yeah. And I think in English, it's a very similar thing, but possibly even more so for geography, because it's even more critical to get those very precise terms, that critical mass of tier three terms, to properly be able to not just understand it, but actually but then be able to communicate in a very specific way as an expert in that field. Because, and I think this is really, I'm going to be honest here, because I initially, just for everyone who's listening, I asked Kate about, could you do a podcast about disciplinary literacy with me, and what was your response, just so we can be completely clear with everyone?
My response was kind of,
because I was put back in my box, everyone. I was put right back in my box.
My response was, yes, we can do the podcast on that. Of course we can. But it's kind of been done. And my response was, I'm not sure what I've got to say to add to the conversation about disciplinary literacy, because I feel like personally I have contributed to, but also enjoyed, a lot of discussion, a lot of podcasts, a lot of roundtables, a lot of thinking about disciplinary literacy. And I think, you know, we've had a lot of these conversations, which is absolutely fine. What we've done, what you and I thus far, Andy, have done is kind of actually really got into like the challenges of it, which is less spoken about, less spoken about actually, okay, but this is really, really difficult to do well. So yeah, my first reaction was, do you really want another podcast discussing disciplinary literacy? But we came up with some debates that we could have that were fresh.
And I just think it's so interesting, because what I'm finding is, and I've always felt a little bit kind of almost embarrassed about the fact that I look at some tier two words and think, is that not a tier three word? Am I going to sound silly if I say, is that a tier? Well, it might be a tier three word to you if you're an idiot, but actually it's not the case, is it? It's a case of if you understand the nuance of what that word means. So I think, and this is where the difficulty in the debate comes in, is that it's not just about thinking like a geographer and doing like a geographer and all that stuff. It's about actually not being scared to have the debate around the complexity of these individual words and these concepts. And I've written recently a blog about, I think we need to almost undergo a shift away from vocabulary list and vocabulary teaching towards conceptually driven, celebrating the idea that a word isn't just a word, it's a concept. It's a concept that's going to support kind of broader and more meaningful understanding. And I think that's when you can start to have, you know, you said about GDP, actually, I think you've got to come away from a fluffy definition, because I went through my school career with a fluffy definition and it probably didn't do me any good in the end, like it hasn't just now. but I think it's really important to actually understand the nuance of it. So if it was up to you, where do you think the debate would most fruitfully shift next? Where do you think the conversation needs to focus next when it comes to this? Because I like the idea that, for example, something like Mapper, because I've looked at the terms on Mapper and said, oh, that's really easy. What's that doing on Mapper? But then when you read the specific definition, it's like, oh, no, there's more to it than that. So where do you think things need to shift next if you had your say over it?
You know, it's happening in the community. It does happen. The problem is it takes time. But the most valuable thing for me is to sit down with someone and say, right, let's talk about our curriculum through the lens of vocabulary. So let's talk about tectonic. Mm. Where do you teach tectonics in Key Stage 3? Okay, whatever your answer to that question is going to have an impact on the vocabulary. Because if you do tectonics before you do development, then your tectonics unit may be, I suspect, much more grounded in the physical geography without the development lens. And wow. So the vocabulary that you use in that tectonics topic is going to be very different. If you do tectonics, say in year 9, after you've done development in year 8, then when you come to compare two earthquakes, which the majority of schools do, let's say Japan and Haiti 2011 and 2010, other way around, sorry. When you come to compare those two earthquakes, if you've done development before in your curriculum, then the vocabulary you use in your tectonic scheme of work is likely to be the physical underpinnings, but then also that development language as well, because you probably will be comparing, like the development, you'll add a development lens when looking at the severity of what happened and the severity of the impacts. So
that's just blowing my mind.
What I enjoy doing, and I think we need to move towards more, is kind of saying, right, let's discuss our curriculum through the vocabulary. So let's look at our curriculum and then
the sequencing of it, right?
And then the sequencing and say, right, as a result, what vocabulary do you introduce where? So, you know, that can be as simple as two people sitting down with their curriculum maps and saying, right, where's the first time that your year sevens hear the word infrastructure? Now, I would throw it out there that a lot of people don't know the answer to that question. And I was certainly in that position as well, that for many years I didn't know the answer. It was basically very ad hoc, like it depended on when the teacher threw the word infrastructure out there. And I think in terms of really progressing this work forwards, those are the sort of conversations we need to have, either as a subject community across different schools or within the same school. You know, in the departmental meeting, sit down and say, okay, year seven, it's Christmas. It's Christmas year seven. What words have our year sevens heard? Have they heard infrastructure yet? If the answer is no, it's not a problem. Like, it doesn't matter. You've made different curriculum choices. But when are they going to hear that first word, infrastructure? Are you all aligned on it? Another example would be something like sustainability. So have you explicitly taught them sustainability yet? No. Or is it ad hoc? Are people throwing it out there kind of when they fancy? But actually that could then end up leading to misconceptions later down the line. So I think approaching your curriculum or thinking about your curriculum with vocabulary at the core of what you're doing, at the fore of those conversations, is so powerful. Now, slight disclaimer, at the second school I was at, I said we were a very stable team for 4 years. It was probably only in year 3 of working together that we were in a position to start thinking about this really deeply. Mm. So So I don't want people to listen to this and be like, how on earth, if you're going in and you're overhauling key stage three, you're overhauling the knowledge, you're overhauling the resources, and you want to throw in vocabulary mapping. That's not the reality. And it certainly wasn't the reality for me. It was a year three thing. So it was, okay, year one, let's overhaul our knowledge. Let's think about our sequencing. Let's think about our curriculum choices. Year two, let's embed, let's refine, let's get there. Year two, we had a real focus on core knowledge. So what is the core knowledge in each of those lessons in the scheme of work? And then through that, we could kind of unlock this new focus in year three, which was, okay, we know what the core knowledge is. So let's focus on the vocabulary, and let's focus on the vocabulary that enables them to get that core knowledge. Just a slight disclaimer there, that obviously to do some deep thinking about mapping out your vocabulary and thinking about exposure to vocabulary is a big thing. And I don't think you can do it in your first year of working together or your first year of curriculum tweaking.
We certainly couldn't when I did it. And I like to think that we, you know, in terms of outcomes and things and what the pupils fed us back at my last school, we achieved real success with that. But I would completely echo what you've just said. You can't do everything at once, and you have to be prepared to play the long game with this. But one thing I really like that chime with what my thinking is, and something we always say at Bedrock, is you have to kind of, you can't take the chance that vocabulary is going to be just caught at chance. It has to be taught, not caught. And I think that's really important at whatever level you're doing. And you can't do everything all the time, but I think it's really important. If you're going to have credibility and integrity as a teacher in the room and as a curriculum leader and as leader in a school, I think you really do need to make space for those conversations to happen. And that's what I always say when, for example, with Mapper, more so than our core programs, when I say with Mapper, what you've got with Mapper, for example, and by the way, it doesn't have to be Mapper, it could be various other things that, you know, vocab lists that you come up with. But what you've got is even with the internet, even, you've got incredible knowledge in the palm of your hand, incredible knowledge. But actually, it's more important to make space for the conversation to happen and your intent to happen and the sequencing to happen. That's what's more important, because then, if nothing else, you're singing off the same hymn sheet and you've got a shared, almost meta understanding of how that curriculum is going to unfold in the classroom for the learners.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, anyone listening to this and thinking, okay, so where do I get started? Get started with those conversations.
Yep.
Get started with, okay, in our next departmental meeting, what's the next topic coming up? What words are we introducing to those students for the first time? Which words are we drawing on from previous topics? Now, of course, words and core knowledge are so intertwined. So you're going to end up your conversation's going to end up crossing over. If you're sitting down saying, right, we're going to start, we're going to talk about the year eight rivers topic that's coming up. So what is the vocabulary they're going to be introduced to in that first lesson? What they're going to be introduced to? The watershed, the drainage basin, erosion. Oh, hang on, but they've already heard erosion in coasts, for example. That would be an example of, you know, where there's two, the vocabulary and the core knowledge is very, very intertwined. But it's not a false dichotomy, it's just the lens through which you're thinking about it. And
I don't think that sort of understanding, like you've just articulated there, I don't think that happens, that kind of understanding. That doesn't happen by accident. That happens because you have gone through that process, or you've almost been through that process just now yourself again. And I think that those things aren't mutually exclusive, and it happens, and it's that we come full circle almost. That is disciplinary literacy, isn't it? Understanding the intertwinedness, if that's even a word, between those concepts and words and topics.
Yeah. But I think, as we've said, that's your good starting point to open up the conversation.
I agree.
Sit down with the team and say, right, let's have a conversation about vocabulary in this next topic. And, you know, you'll be like, in my experience, you'd be surprised at the richness of the conversation that then comes out, and the richness of the discussion that you have about the teaching that's coming up, recognizing that everyone's going to teach in a slightly different way and everyone's got a diverse teaching style and everyone wants to approach it in a different way. Absolutely. We're not forgetting that at all, but we're aligning on that exposure and that teaching of specific vocabulary to make sure that basically it's not left up to chance as to who your geography teacher is and when they throw out the word. But it is mapped out more consistently and coherently, and you know when you're getting that knowledge through vocabulary.
Yeah, and something that, again, that I've heard recently, I love this turn of phrase, it's about the democratization of knowledge. and the democratization of the expert, almost the idea that everyone, every teacher gets access to a quality curriculum that they can deliver and have a, have an input in, but also every learner has the right to experience a certain level of knowledge and experience and through the lens that the teacher is presenting it. And I think one thing that we've got to get back to in education in general is the mantle of the teacher is the expert, the teaching that you've done a degree in a lot of the time in this subject. You're the expert in the room. Let's celebrate that. And let's be unashamedly academic. And I think that, yeah, so yeah, I think that's a nice note to leave it on. And without anything else, just so thank you so much for being my first guest, and I hope it wasn't too painful for you, but it's been a real pleasure just listening to someone who's obviously so passionate about what they do. It's been so lovely.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for having me. Always wonderful to talk geography. And as you say, kind of a note to leave on is this is, in my opinion, you know, the best bit of teaching is thinking about those curriculum decisions, those curriculum choices, whatever you want to call it. This is the bit that keeps us learning as adults, as well as the people we're teaching. And so, you know, you comment on, you sound so passionate, but actually it's the best bit. It's the best bit. And particularly in a subject like geography, where people are going to disagree with some things I've said because they want to do something slightly differently. You know, that's not to say that I'm right and they're wrong.
We can approach
it in different ways to the same outcome. But as long as you've got that thinking behind it, and as long as you've thought about that process and why you're doing what you're doing, you know, we're all wanting to get to the same goal. And that's what makes it so great.
And I think that's a really lovely place to leave it on, because I think that, you know, we are all trying to get to the same place, and it's about respecting and celebrating that, and which is lovely. So Kate Stockings, thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
And then the recording stops.
Perfect.
Thank you. You were phenomenal. Thank you so much. That was